You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Legal Ethics in Contract Drafting. I am pleased to introduce our speakers. Joining us from Chicago is Anthony Licata. Mr. Licata is a partner, Taft, Stettinius & Hollister, LLP, where he formerly chaired the firm's real estate practice. He has an extensive practice focusing on major commercial real estate transactions, including finance, development leasing, and land use. He formerly served as an adjunct professor at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University and at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Joining us from McLean, Virginia, is Thomas Spahn. Mr. Spahn is a partner with the McGuire Woods LLP, where he is a commercial litigator and regularly advises corporate and other clients on ethics and attorney-client privilege and related matters. He has served on the ABA, Standing Committee of Ethics and Professional Responsibility. He is a member of the American Law Institute and a fellow of the American Bar Foundation. He is the author of the 1,500-page treatise, The Attorney-Client Privilege and the Work-Product Doctrine, published by the Virginia Law Foundation. Mr. Licata, I am pleased to hand the program over to you.
Thank you and welcome everyone. In the next hour, Tom and I will discuss major ethical issues when lawyers draft contracts. And we had talked about this before, and we want to also say that in addition to just outright drafting of contracts, we want to cover the whole broader waterfront, if you will, of transactions ethics generally. Specifically things like what do you do in disputes about closing statements, due diligence, negotiations. And I think a great place to start this discussion, Tom, is with the famous discussion about the ability to make puffing statements. That's P-U-F-F-I-N-G, and that's as opposed to bluffing statements. Tom, give us a little bit of your expertise on that topic.
Sure, Tony. It's great working with you. I know you actually do transactional work. I'm a litigator by trade when I get to do that, and I'm kind of an ethics geek most of the time. So I'm looking forward to hearing how you handle this stuff, because I'm going to come at it kind of in an abstract way, both from the ethics side and also from the litigation side. But the ethics rules prevent you from lying, and that's kind of not surprising. You'd think that that lawyers would be prohibited from lying, and they are. There's really two places in the ethics rules in most states where you find that prohibition. One is in representing a client. It says, in the course of representing a client, a lawyer shall not knowingly, I'll read here, make a false statement, a material fact or law to a third person. And then there's another rule that follows right after that, or a subpart. In the course of representing a client, lawyer shall not fail to disclose a material fact when disclosure is necessary to avoid assisting a criminal or fraudulent act by a client. And that one's a tricky one, frankly. It's a lot of people don't realize that. Some of the states say that unless it's protected by a confidentiality duty, then you don't have a duty to do it. But some say, some just say, like my state of Virginia, the only state I'm licensed, even if it would violate your duty of confidentiality, you have to correct it. The other rule that is a fascinating rule to me, because I think all this is fascinating, but it's the rule that comes from 8.4. As you probably heard, Tony, I started reading the 4.1 ABA model rules that starts with "in the course of representing a client." Some of the rules start with that phrase in the ethics rules, and some of them don't. The ones that do, of course, just say it's only in a representational capacity that you're bound by that rule. That's like the ex parte communication rule. You can't talk to somebody who is a lawyer if you're representing a client. If you're not representing a client, if you are the client, for instance, then you can talk to people ex parte, even if they have a lawyer. The 8.4 rule is to me almost humorous, the ABA one. We have a different one at Virginia, but it says this rule starts out, it is professional misconduct for a lawyer. So this one follows you wherever you go. It follows you in your personal life. And let me just read this and see how broad it is. Then I'll get back to answer your question. It is this is 8.4C in the ABA model rules. It is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, period. Now, so there's no exception for that. Now, compare that to the preceding subpart about criminal conduct. It is professional misconduct for a lawyer to commit a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. So you can commit a criminal act and not be punished professionally if it doesn't reflect adversely on your honesty, trustworthiness, and so on. But it is a flat ethics violation for you to engage in any conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. So the next time your wife asks you if you're a guy, or a friend asks you, you know, do you like this pie? If your wife says, you know, does this dress make me look heavy? You can't lie. Do you like the meatloaf tonight? You've got to tell the truth. Well, that can't be, it can't possibly be enforced the way it's written. And so, of course, the ABA can't change it now because think of the press release that would say ABA permits lying. So let me go back to the representational one, and then I'll shut up here in a minute. The issue that comes up here is whether it's a false statement of material fact. The material law, fact or law, the law part is maybe a little bit easier, but although not necessarily. But the problem is that when you, let's say you're in negotiation, I'd love to know how you did it, Tony, but if you're in negotiation and your client says, you know, I'll pay $2 million for that apartment building, so, you know, see what you can do for it, but I'm willing to pay up to two. And the other side says, you know, will your client be willing to take two? And you say, go, I don't think so. You know, I think they're going to want about, you know, they're going to, or will they do it less of the other way? You know, your client says that they won't pay more than two, and the other side says, will they pay more than two? And you basically lie about what they're willing to take. It's a used car dealer kind of thing. And that's puffing, but we don't want to call it lying, but it is. I mean, you're basically materially misrepresenting something. That is what your client's willing to do. It's one thing to say, well, you know, I don't know, or I'm not going to tell you what the bottom line is, but that's not the way negotiations work. So let me read the rule, and then I'll turn it over to you. So, go ahead, Tony.
Go ahead, read the rule, then I'll give you my insight.
Yeah. Good, because I want to lay the ethics thing out, and I can't wait to hear what you have to say about it. The ABA has this, again, almost a humorous comment for 4.1 that says this: this rule refers to statements of fact. Whether a particular statement should be regarded as one of fact can depend on the circumstances. Under generally accepted conventions in negotiation, certain types of statements ordinarily are not taken as statements of material fact. Estimates of price or value placed on the subject of a transaction and a party's intentions as to an acceptable settlement of a claim are ordinarily in this category. Well, why is that? So there's this cultural understanding that in negotiations people are gonna lie, and it's acceptable, but we don't want to call it lying, so we call it puffing. So what's your take on this one, Tony? I'm coming at it as an ethics abstract geek guy.
Got it. My take on it is that the client would typically say to you, as opposed to a hard, fast, firm number, you're better off to have them suggest to them, if you're really troubled about this puffing issue, you should say that how much will they take if they're a seller? They will take as much as they can get. Or how much would they pay if they are the buyer? Well, I want to pay as little as I have to.
Right.
And then you ask them to give you a range, and they say, well, I'd like to get as much. If I could get $2 million, I'd be really happy, but I don't know about the low side. And you say, okay, well, let's see what we can get. And so you start the other side off at $2 million. I don't really think, Tom, when you're in a lawyer's role, but let's face it, we end up as the deal middle persons.
Right.
You know, you're a facilitator to the transaction, and by facilitating to the transaction, as often as not, you're as much a broker, frankly, as you are a lawyer when you're in those kind of issue discussions. So again, I think in my view of it, if you can get the client to say, listen, obviously if I'm selling, I want to get as much as I can get. Let's start at 2. And I guess I would go and you typically say, I want to know how low I can go.
Right.
Because I don't, you don't want to say to somebody if you're way apart, it's important to be able to say in the negotiation fairly early on, and we've all done this, guys, we're not even in the same, forget ballpark, forget planet, we're not even in the same galaxy.
Right.
So, you can save everybody a lot of time, trouble, and effort if you do that sort of thing. So I think that if you stay focused on issues of how much would the other side take to either settle in the case of a litigation, or demand in the case of a litigation, or in a buy sell, or in a landlord tenant, what's the rent going to be? Well, landlord might go as low as $18, but their asking price is $22.50. That's all, and I don't consider those to be really facts, Tom, in the sense that, what I had for lunch yesterday is a fact.
Right.
What I would be willing to pay for lunch today is open to negotiation. Maybe that's putting too fine of a gilding on the lily for you. I don't know.
Well, yeah, but it is a fact, though. I mean, in the sense that now it may be that it's just the verbs that are used or the adjectives that are used. But I mean, a lot of times somebody will, especially like in the insurance defense world, the insurance company will give you a certain amount of a set fee that they're willing to take, some authority to settle a case or not. But if you were to, if even through kind of body language, if you're negotiating a real estate deal, you might be able to, you might hurt your client by conveying, not, holding out. I'm thinking of the art of the deal sort of thing. We're seeing this going on with China tariffs, as we're talking about this now. You have to basically mislead the other side about what your intention is. And that's how you'd make a good deal. And that's culturally fine. I mean, it's not a problem. Let's just sort of acknowledge what it is. Basically the best negotiators are the ones that mislead the other side about what they're willing to do. In fact, there's a 1980 American Bar Foundation article. It's standard. This is from a while ago. Standard negotiating technique for one side to include a series of demands about which it cares little or not at all. And it says, this is for settlement, a plaintiff might insist it will not agree to resolve a dispute for less than $200 when in reality it's willing to accept as little as $150. A party in negotiation might exaggerate or emphasize the strengths or de-emphasize the weakness of its factual or legal position.
Right.
And they're distinguishable from the flat facts. I mean, what the hospital bill was, that's for sure. But it seems to me
Tom, isn't one of the key issues, though, obviously you cannot engage in improper conduct such as committing a crime or participant to a fraud or aiding and abetting a fraud or a conspiracy. We all accept that.
Yeah.
But outside of that, as a general rule, isn't it a good rule of thumb? You don't owe any obligation to the other side in a transaction. Especially if they have a lawyer themselves, and that leads me to one of the first big questions here. What happens when you know that the other side has made legal assumptions which are incorrect? Tell us what the law says about that. In other words, I'm in a negotiation with somebody, and I say, and let's just say I just ran into this morning, literally. The client is talking to the other side about making a particular deal, and I say to the client privately, obviously, the way he's trying to do this, he's going to owe a very substantial transfer tax.
Right.
And there's ways to avoid it, by the way. His lawyer doesn't know what he's doing. And so, Tom, tell us legally, am I obligated to tell the other side, look, you ding-dongs, you're going to owe a big tax here, and let me get your take on should I tell them that, and B, should I tell them I know how to avoid it and structure the transaction, and what should I do about that? Let us
well,
know.
You,
Yeah. And then I'll tell you what I do, what I did.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's let me before we leave the other topic, let me just mention a 2016 article, from the Seventh Circuit, where the Seventh Circuit reversed a wire fraud conviction of a bank VP who was convicted. I think he might have already been in prison for self-dealing. And this is what the Seventh Circuit said. So I'm kind of playing the devil's advocate here on this one, Tony. But it says no previous case at the appellate level has treated as criminal a person's lack of candor about the negotiating positions of parties to a business deal. In commercial transaction, it is not unusual for parties to conceal from others their true goals, values, or reserve prices. Some deception certainly can support a mail or wire fraud. For example, a seller may not falsely tell potential buyers the piece of property has no history of environmental problems if soil and groundwater contamination on the property was discovered the year before. But the central issue in this case is whether the mail and wire fraud statutes can be stretched to criminalize deception about a party's negotiating position, such as a party's bottom line reserve price or how important a particular non-price item is. We conclude that it cannot. And so you're exactly right, Tony, about this being acceptable to do it. It's just it's intellectually kind of frustrating for me because it clearly is deception. So to answer your question, you do not have a duty, and I want to kick it back in your field here because you actually do the stuff, but you do not have a duty to explain the law. And so if the other side is about to stumble into some mistake like the way you describe, it seems to me you have a duty to your client because that's who we serve. You have a duty to take advantage of that. But I would think, and we talked about this earlier, I would think that you might be able to talk your client into explaining it for that is, especially if it doesn't hurt your client, then you generate all sorts of goodwill, it seems to me. But on the legal side, it's a totally different world when you're in court, because as a litigator, and I go to court, I have a duty to tell the court about bad law, either in the controlling jurisdiction or that's controlling outside the court. I do not have a duty to tell the other side about bad law. So if we're trying to settle a case or entering into some contract to settle a case or some other litigation-related matter, I have a duty not to tell them. And so if it's a legal issue, so I would think that absent concerns about your reputation, for instance, or absent concerns about some future business relationships, that you would stay silent there. You certainly have no duty to do it unless you meet that 4.1, unless your silence assists your client's crime or fraud. That's a pretty high standard that would be difficult to violate, frankly. But how would you handle that?
Well, I tell you what I did, and this is what I would typically do, and that is I would take the client aside, and I did this today. I called the client and said, listen, I can see where this is going, Mr. Client. The other side is making a mistake. They don't understand that what they're attempting to do is going to trigger a big transfer tax. Now, we can go down that primrose path with them. And I, based on all my experience after 39 years of doing this, what will happen is somewhere along the way they will discover that mistake, and then they'll be back in here wanting to renegotiate or insisting that we change it, and there's enough other issues in the transaction, enough other contractual outs that the buyer has. It's not in our best interest right now to have them go down this primrose path and then spring it and then have them discover later and be in a big delay situation as you get closer to the closing. And the client agreed. He said, you know what, you're right. Go ahead and tell them they've made a mistake, and because I don't want to be in the situation that you described. And so in that case, client did the right thing. Sometimes the client may not do the right thing. Sometimes the client may say, listen, it's not my problem. And then you say, well, okay, you understand, but they might try to get out of the deal for some other reason, which they might have a right to do, and maybe you'd be better off. But at some point, at least in my approach to these things, Tom, get your thoughts on this. Mm-hmm. Client has a right to make certain decisions and take certain risks. As long as you have laid all the options in front of the client, then the client makes the decision. And again, on something like the situation where I'm describing, what the other side is doing is not a crime. We're not evading, aiding and abetting a fraud. We're not engaging in a conspiracy to money launder. We're not doing anything like that. We're just, you know, somebody thinks they can do something a certain way, and it turns out they're going to owe more money than they're realizing. And as a general rule, I agree with you. I don't think we have a duty to tell them that they've made that mistake. And by the same token, as we said earlier, you know, if they say how much will your client take, and you can say, well, the client is asking $2 million, and they say, yeah, but what will he really take? And you say, well, the client wants to get as much as he can. What's your best offer? And I try to play it that way. I try to avoid lying about bluffing and puffing. I tell people that this is our position. This is fact. Try to avoid lying whenever possible.
Well, so, Tom, yeah, you answered. Let me ask you a question here. You answered one question I had as you explained the situation that you face, and that is it would not cost your client anything. They were just going to pay. The other side is going to pay more tax and may try to get out of the deal because they don't want to pay the additional tax. What would you recommend your client do if it would the law actually would say that that if they do it a certain way, it would fall on your client? In other words, or let's say that they there was a legal position that, because the way you described, let me back up for a second, the way you described it was all their mistake about the law, and they were the ones that were going to suffer, but it wouldn't affect your client at all. So it was pretty easy for you to be, for your client to take the moral high ground. But what if there was one where they didn't understand the law, and they could, if they did something differently, they could make your client pay the tax, but they didn't understand that law. In that case, would you still explain the same thing to your client? Because then your client would suffer. What would you do?
I think you'd be duty bound to tell first the client that what they're proposing is going to cause you to pay more money. The client will say, well, that's crazy. I'm not going to do that. And then you say, okay, so here's how to do it correctly. And he would say, well, go ahead and why don't you propose that to him? So that one I think is easy. What's harder is when the other side is making a mistake. And it's not so much a mistake on the law, but it's just a mistake on something like, say, zoning. They think they're going to be able to get a zone. This is one we most commonly run into in real estate, by the way.
Yeah.
You have a piece of property, and it's currently zoned, say, for agricultural use. And the buyer comes to you and says, I want to buy the property. And I'm going to pay X dollars. And we go, well, that's a very attractive price. We're happy to take that. And they go, yeah, but we believe we can get zoning for a gas station on this property. Mm-hmm. And you and the client roll your eyes because you know that for the last 5 years you've been trying to get a gas station there, and the city has told you no on multiple occasions. Typically in that situation, you know, the client will say to the other side, listen, hey, we've tried for years to get that property rezoned, but if you think you can do it and you're willing to pay to try, be our guest. So again, we've been honest about what we found, you know, in our past dealings. And by the way, I don't think a prediction of the future is necessarily a misrepresentation of a fact. As a matter of fact, I told some people I didn't think Tiger Woods could win the Masters this year, and look at what happened. So predictions of the future I don't think are matters of fact, and I don't see how you can make a misrepresentation about what a prediction of the future might be. I think you can say, if they ask you, Tom, if they point blank ask you, have you ever talked to the city about rezoning this, I think you have to tell the truth. Yes, we have. Well, how did it go? Not very good. That's what we would say.
Would you raise it on your own if they didn't? If they were just to say that, would you let it sit there? In other words, if they said we're pretty sure we'll get it, would you speak up and say, oh, I wouldn't be sure of that. We've tried. Or would you stay silent?
The only circumstances in which I might speak up and tell somebody in that particular instance would be if we still own some other property nearby or next door or something like that, and if they did get it, it could have an adverse effect on us or our relations with our neighbors or something like that. But generally, no. If they say, we know we have to get it rezoned and we think we can get it, I say, listen, God bless you. Good luck. Godspeed. Go knock them out, you know, and mm-hmm. go after it. Because you never know what they know, by the way. One of the great realities of these situations is people generally, Tom, do not do stupid things. And over all the many years in terms of pursuing stuff. And so, I mean, they do a lot of stupid things in their personal life and private life and so forth, and they make stupid business mistakes all the time. I'm talking about when you see somebody in a transaction doing something that you think doesn't make any sense, sometimes mm-hmm. the case, Tom, they know something you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. And particularly yeah. on something like whether you could get a zoning change, or they may know that the state is getting ready to put a highway in that you don't know about. So, again, as long as you don't make any factual mistakes, misstatements yourself, or, you know, faulty statements about the law, that's really faulty factual assumptions is the second topic that we had on our list for
right.
today. Just a natural segue over into that. So you do have a faulty factual assumption made by the counterparty. Must you correct them? And I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
Using one we just used. Client comes and says, or the other side calls and says, hey, we want to buy your property, and I just want to be sure. The zoning allows for a 10-story building, right?
Right. Yeah, got it.
What am I, and I happen to know that the zoning doesn't allow a 10-story building. It only allows a 4-story building. What is my obligation to tell him? Am I allowed to tell him, hey, go read the zoning code yourself and figure it out? I'm not making any representations about what the zoning allows.
That's a great scenario, but the way you described it seems to me, when they turn to you and say, right, you can't lie to them and say, right. You'd have to kind of dance around it and say, well, you know, that's up to you. There's a really interesting case to get a little bit off point, but it's a real estate case, just as you described. I think it was from New Jersey, and it talks about what's called an at-issue waiver on the privilege side, where exactly that. Somebody bought some land and thought they were going to be able to build a certain number of units of residential housing on it, ended up not being able to do that, and so they sued the seller and said, you defrauded us. You made us think that we could build so many apartment units and we can't. And the seller, defending itself, pointed to the contract, which said we're going to do our own due diligence and we're going to rely on our own lawyers, among others. And they used that language to say, listen, buyer, we want to see all what your lawyer at the time was telling you about what you could build on the land. And, of course, the buyer said, well, that's privilege. That's legal advice. And the court said, well, no, it is, but you put that at issue. You were claiming ignorance. You're claiming you relied on the seller and the seller defrauded you. And you can't expect to take advantage of your ignorance without telling us what your lawyer was saying. So to get back to your point, so there's a privilege implication of that as well. But the tougher question is not if they turn to you and say, right, if they're talking to their lawyer and you're just sitting across the table from them and say, and they say to the lawyer, I mean, just as part of the conversation, or say, I'm going to show you a picture of this 14-story building we plan to build on this property. Isn't that good looking? What would you do then? Would you say, well, that's interesting, but don't expect to build one that's, you know, more than four stories? Or would you just say, oh, well, that's really a pretty looking building? What, I don't know what you do there. I mean, you have a duty not to educate them about the facts without your client's consent. You can always do it with your client's consent. But absent the client's consent, I would think that you, if they ask you right, you can't lie to them. But if they don't ask you, they just talk about it as if they're going to get the 14-story building. I would think you'd have a duty to stay silent, absent the reputational issue that you have, and absent that sort of thing. How would you handle that one?
I would take the client aside and say, listen, Mr. Client, I understand this would be great if they would try to buy the property for this higher price based on this. They clearly think they can build something. I think it is in your enlightened best interest, Mr. Client, to not go down this primrose path with them. They cannot build this without substantial relief. They are not going to be able to get the relief that they're calling for in the time of the You know, usually contract gives them 30, 45, 60 days to close. And we all know from our practice that if you had to get a change in zoning or you had to get some special permit or some kind of entitlement, you're not going to get that done in that period of time. And so you're going to be here on day 59, the time period will be expiring, they can't close. And what's going to happen is then you'll be looking at an extension or making starting over with another buyer. Most of the time, people who are experienced in the business, and this applies to selling, buying and selling businesses too, and not corporate businesses, just not just real estate, but people who are experienced in the business will realize that time is money, and if you get your time wasted because the other side has just made a mistake, they don't understand something, you're better off to get that out in front of the other side and make sure everybody's on the same page. Otherwise, what happens is the deal blows up, everybody wasted their time, your client's angry now because he's got to pay your legal bill and the deal didn't happen. Now, sometimes they put such a high price on it, the client says, you know what, I hear all that, Tony, but I'll tell you what, for this kind of price, let's see what happens. And then you say, okay. But at least you discussed it with the client. You have at least you know the clear mind of knowing that you tried to tell them and you didn't have to do that. So.
So we agree that you don't have an ethical duty to educate them, I guess. Yeah, got it. And how often? What percentage of the time do your clients say, "Oh, let's just keep our mouths shut and see what happens"? Is that rare?
No, I would say hard to generalize on that question, Tom. It just depends on how attractive the offer is. If the offer is for a high enough price, they'll say, "Hey, let's give it a shot and see what happens." There's nothing better hanging around a rim. Let's see what happens. If it's a price they're not that enthusiastic about at the outset, then they'll be much more eager not to waste time. And that's a good consideration.
Gotcha.
Well, Tom, we're right at about the halfway point here of this, and so I'd like to turn to our. So I think we've disposed of the first two questions in pretty short form. Let's turn to the third topic that we had agreed upon for today, and the topic of rescission. And the question was, are you ever ethically obligated to try to rescind or restate a contract? And obviously, that's a complicated question. Depends on what the terms of the contract are and the situation. You may not have a legal right to rescind or restate. So give us a little bit about your thoughts there, Tom.
Yeah, well, I guess I think you're right. It's a legal. It comes from the law, unless it's a product of some kind of deception, either by your client or from you. I don't think there's much of an ethics angle there. It seems to me rescission. If I think it's going to be mostly governed by law, but can we go? It seems to me we ought to. If we go back to two more kind of mistakes, it seems to me, if that's all right.
Go ahead.
We talk about you don't have to educate the law. You don't have a duty to educate them about facts. And I think there's two more, as we sort of extend this out, two more things. One is not so much a factual error, but a substantive mistake in the drafting process. And then the Scrivener's error is fascinating to me, too. I tracked down that thing we talked about before we started here today, the story of a substantive mistake, which kind of makes your blood run cold if you're a transactional lawyer. But it comes from a 2015 example of what can go wrong. It's a Mayor Brown paralegal made a mistake. General Motors had two synthetic leases that wanted to pay off. And it was going to release J.P. Morgan of the security interest on those two. I don't know what a synthetic lease is. It sounds kind of fishy to me, but I know you probably deal with them. But anyway, the paralegal accidentally came up with the wrong number and included not just a synthetic lease, but actually was another term loan that J.P. Morgan had made to GM. And the paralegal apparently, and the lawyer, the young associate apparently knew that it was a mistake too. They were using an old list apparently, and so but Mayor Brown was representing GM, and of course J.P. Morgan was the one that was releasing the security interest. So Mayor Brown representing GM did the deal, made the mistake, but then they handed off to Simpson Thatcher, who was the bank's lawyer. And the bank's lawyer, GM's bank's lawyer at Simpson Thacher, missed it. They're the ones that should have checked to make sure they weren't going to release the security interest on this term loan. Well, it came to light when GM went bankrupt and the unsecured creditors said, hey, you know, J.P. Morgan, what are you doing over the secured line? You're with us. You released the security on this term loan. And they said, well, no, we didn't. It was two synthetic leases. They said, oh, there it is. Well, the term loan was for $1.5 billion. And so that was a mistake, a $1.5 billion mistake, which not surprisingly has resulted in some litigation, which is, of course, good from my side of the courtroom. But we're not involved in that case. But in that case, what would you do if somebody makes a substantive mistake that advantages your client? It seems to me, then we'll get to Scrivener's error, which is kind of the, at the end of the process. But you normally, unless it involves your silence assisting your client's fraud, and that would be our crime. Fraud would be typical if your client had made a representation before you got involved or in your absence. You can't just stay silent. You have to correct that if it would be fraud to continue it. But I mean, all of us make mistakes. But in that case, in the litigation world, of course, we always take advantage of the other side's mistakes. If the other side misses an argument, we don't just say, hey, you should make this argument. If the other side louses up a deposition, we don't say, hey, you know, you ought to ask this question. In your world, what would you do? I've got one partner who says, oh, no, if they see the other side making a mistake, they always say, hey, you're making a mistake, because they don't want to get in litigation. But how would you handle that issue? That's fascinating to me, because I think from my standpoint, you have a duty not to tell the other side if it makes a mistake in the negotiation or the drafting.
Yeah, I'm sort of in the camp with your partner. I think at the end of the day, when all the dust settles, you're all better. Everybody's better off to get it right as opposed to try to exploit or monopolize or take advantage of somebody else's mistake, particularly if this mistake involves attaching the wrong description or identifying the wrong collateral and you realize the other side has done that. Sooner or later, you're going to be facing an action for reformation of the document. Mm-hmm. That'll be time-consuming, expensive. You're going to if it's big enough, you're going to force the other side to do that. And I can tell you from my own personal experience running the law firm for 20 years, there's no law firm in America that has $1.5 billion of malpractice insurance coverage.
Right.
At least, yeah. Not that I know of. And so a mistake like that is so stunningly colossal that it's, you know, shocks the conscience and would be unfair to any sense of, you know, square dealing and fair play that sort of underlies most of our jurisprudence. And I just think you'd be better off. I think you're going to spend the rest of your career litigating that decision that you made not to tell the other side when you realize they were making the mistake. Now, maybe it was just an honest mistake and nobody paid attention. That really does get you closer to the mutual mistake of fact, which puts you into the rescission or reformation of a document case law. I just think life is too short. You should live on. You have to look at yourself in the mirror every day, ethically, and you know, you're better off to just and I don't know. I guess if you have a duty to the client not to tell anybody and let your client try to scarf $1.5 billion, I don't know.
Well, that would be a good deal, especially out of the contingency.
Have you committed malpractice? If you tell the other side and it gets corrected, and they did not benefit from their mistake, I don't see that either.
That's the point exactly. And it may be that because we come from different worlds. But I spoke at a law school recently, and I gave the following scenario from the litigation world. And you can make it as sort of poignant as you want. But let's say that you just won a case against your litigator. The other litigant on the other side of the case is your best friend from law school, you know, childhood buddy, and you call him, and because your client wants to know if they're going to appeal, and your buddy says, oh yeah, you know, we're going to appeal this, and I'll be working all weekend on it. And yet, you know, the filing deadline for the notice of appeal is Friday. So your best friend is about to commit per se malpractice, and let's say it's a $1 million case, and he's going to get fired because he's committing malpractice. He's about to miss a deadline that is irretrievable. You cannot pursue the appeal if he misses the deadline. He's about to miss it. And then I know somebody's piled on and said he's got two kids. He just bought a new house. His wife's pregnant. I mean, make it as tear-jerking as you want. And I asked these law students, you know, what do you do? And they'll say, oh, you got to tell him. You got to tell him he's about to make a mistake. And I'll say, no, this is going to sound horrible, but you have a duty not to tell him. So it's unlike your situation in the negotiation transactional world where it'll come back into litigation. I think in this case, absent your client's agreement, in my world, you cannot tell the other side they have made or about to make a horrible mistake. You have a duty not to do it because it's a final victory for your client, unlike yours, it'll just sort of lead to more legal expense. In this case, your client's going to get $1 million out of it, and so you have a duty not to tell your best friend. So it may be that the different world we live in, but a substantive mistake in the drafting process or in the courtroom, usually, it's, I think you have a duty to stay silent. Now, your client can always agree for reputational reasons and all the rest not to stay silent. But one thing I know you've got to do is to not let your own reputation be a factor. In other words, we are servants of our clients. We're champions for our clients. And we can't on our own agree to be good guys in that sense by saying, oh, you know, I know you got a child on the way and you're going to lose your house if you screw up and get fired. I think you have a duty not to do that, even if you get sort of a bad reputation, you can't let that be a factor. You've got to serve your client. So, to me, it's a very painful one, frankly, a painful decision. And a lot of times, I think young lawyers, especially in law students, I know because I talk to them, think that oh no, we're supposed to kind of be fair. I mean, being professional and civil to me is really important, but that's just how we treat each other on a day-to-day basis. It's not what positions we take on behalf of our clients. So I think you have a duty, absent what you've explained, Tony, which is to talk your client into it, I think you have a duty not to tell the other side about substantive errors in the settlement. Let me give you another example if I can. Now, see how you do this one. This is a California example, a legal ethics opinion. Let's say that there's a 50 or 75 page contract, and the other side proposes a change which would eliminate their remedy. For instance, let's say that your client is liable if something goes wrong for some kind of liquidated damages, or let's say the value of goodwill that could be the damages against your client if they don't comply with the contract, and then the other side near the end of the process assigns just a dollar to goodwill, thinking that, you know, for some other reason. And they don't realize that basically takes any potential damages, any exposure to damages totally away from your client. So the California ethics opinion says if they do that and they don't realize the significance of a change on page 58 of a 100-page document, what it's going to affect on page 7, you don't have a duty to tell them about that. That's a mistake that they're making. So. And so that's one question. The next question is, could you affirmatively say near the end of the process, hey, you know what, let's just assign a dollar to goodwill, keeping you know that that's going to ripple back into page 7 and basically eliminate your client's exposure. What would you do if the other side made a mistake like that? And would you ever propose a change like that knowing you'd get some advantage of it? How would you handle something like that?
On situation number one, I don't believe you are under any ethical duty to protect the other side from the nincompoop that they hired for a lawyer.
there you go. Okay.
And it sounds like the California Ethics Commission agrees with me on that. And on the second one, I think you're entitled to make any suggestion in a negotiating process that you might want to make. And I don't think you have any ethical duty to go explain to the other side what all the consequences are of your proposal. You can make a proposal, and it's up to them to have to churn the consequences of all this through the document. One of the things it's why we stress in our training processes so rigorously, I don't know whether hope it works. I hope it's effective. But we stress rigorously, you can't just look at a change that somebody wants to make on page 58 without asking, what else does it impact? And that's why as these things get in these transactions, Tom, as we get closer and closer towards the end, at least in my matter, my own personal practice, and I catch a lot of grief over this over the years, but it's often the case I will generally say to everybody, look, I'm not going to let anybody sign this. I'm going to take this thing home over the weekend if we can avoid it, if we can get that much time. I want to reread the whole document from scratch without any redlining because you'd be surprised at the stuff you catch when you sit down and reread something from scratch as opposed to just from scratch. I mean, read it from the beginning, front to back. Now, maybe that seems really old-fashioned, and a lot of times it's hard to do that because people want to move, and sign this stuff fast and get it done. But this is how you get you know, caught in mistakes is by this very situation. I'll tell you another situation, Tom. Let me ask you one.
Yeah, yeah.
A redlining type question. You have a draft. You send somebody a set of changes, and you tell them you have redlined the changes. Then you have some more negotiations back and forth, and then you come to find out that the red line that you sent out, for whatever reason, was incorrect. You with me? In other words, there were intervening changes that somehow didn't get saved as a separate version. I don't know how that happened, but it did. Anyway, you find out that you sent out an incorrect red line, and the incorrection is a material item. What do you do? Do you call the other side and tell them? Or are you obligated to call the other side and tell them, knowing that you have sent out you sent the document saying, here's a red line that shows all the changes, and that's untrue.
Right.
What you got to do?
Well, I'll raise you one here in a minute. But to me, in that case, that may kick in the 4.1 that says, I think your silence in that case might assist your client's fraud. I mean, it might be constructive fraud, but it seems to me I think it would be improper, and I think you are ethically required under the, either in representing the client rule 4.1 or in the 8.4, the general rule, I think you have a duty to correct that. It seems to me that's a sort of a Scrivener's error. But you're the one that made it, and you can't take advantage of it. But let me see you and raise you on getting into the Scrivener's error one. What happens if the other side, let's say you agree on some changes, and the other side goes back and makes the changes but forgets to make one of the changes. So it's the other side's mistake, and it's to your great advantage. Can you, if they were to say, okay, here it is, I'm ready to sign it, and they haven't included the change that you and the other side agreed to, that's a classic Scrivener's error. What do you think? What would you do then?
Under the circumstances, as you have just laid them out, the document came from them. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there was an agreement that you were going to change provision X, and they forgot to change it to their benefit. Correct?
Yes, yes, yes.
I think you sign that document. And the reason is they've sent it to you saying we're prepared to sign. For all you know, they backed off. They may have decided that they want the deal badly enough that if they send the deal, sometimes they send stuff out and the others, and our side might say, I've been thinking about this, I'm not ready to do that. So they might say, you know what, that point is not that important to us, and I want to get this done, and I'm afraid if I, you know, so just drop. I've had that happen. You agree to change something, and then the client tells you, I really don't care about that. Drop that. I know that the other side cares a lot. We spend all this time arguing about it. Tell you what, go ahead and send it back to them with the change without making that change. Now, typically, when that would happen, when I sent it, I would tell the other side, you will notice that paragraph X has not been changed, even though we talked about it. It's because my client has decided to withdraw that, right? But that's because I'm an ethical guy, and for 39 years, I never got sued by anybody for, you know, lying or cheating or stealing. But I think that certainly if you're sending the document out and it doesn't contain a change that you had previously talked about that would be beneficial to you, but whether you just made a mistake or you did it intentionally or not, you know, now the client may come back to you and say, Tony, client provision X was supposed to be changed and you forgot to do it in your haste to get it out. You screwed it up. You cost me money. I'm going to make a malpractice claim against you. So, you know, that if that happens, you're in trouble because you sent it out. But I don't think the other side got an obligation to tell you.
Well, this is the other side, okay, but I'm asking, I guess, what if the other side, let's say that you shake hands, late one night, you agree to the material changes, the other side sends you an email that says, okay, here's the changes that you know, I worked late last night, you got to go home, Tony, I worked late last night, here's what we agreed to, and there's a scrivener's, they forgot to make one of the changes, would you sign that? And it's clearly, a reasonable person would think it's a scrivener's error. That is that you agreed to something, but they didn't write it down and they just forgot it. Would you sign that one?
No, in that case, I would, as you posited that one, I would call the client and say, listen, we got the new draft. Yeah. I don't understand what happened here. Maybe he was late, he was tired, but in paragraph X, they were supposed to put in $10,000 and they only put in $4,000 that we were going to pay. So he forgot that. Should we call, tell him about that, or should we leave it alone? And I let the client decide.
Isn't that interesting? Because that's fascinating, because that's more aggressive than even I am as a litigator. But the ABA dealt with, the last time the ABA dealt with this, and this is kind of the far edge of what we've been talking about, so it's good to end on this one, it seems to me. In 1986, the ABA dealt with that in an informal ethics opinion and said, you do not even have a duty to tell your client about it because it's not material. What's material is what the deal is, and the deal, which is the oral understanding, the oral handshake meeting of the minds, that's what's material to tell the client. So you do not even give the client and I'm not saying this is right, but you don't even give the client the choice of having you sign it. And then the ABA said you have a duty to tell the other side, hey, remember we agreed last night, we shook hands, we had a meeting of minds, you were supposed to change it to $10,000, you didn't change it. So the ABA said that, and I can't really find anything since then that dealt with it. And I think the reason may be that the courts, and like you were talking about before, Tony, the whole mutual mistake and reformation and everything, I think the law outside the ethics world is so clear that you can't take advantage of the other side's scrivener's error like that, that the bars don't even want to talk about it because they'd be forced to say, yes, you can. It's a different kind of mistake, and you can take advantage of the other side's mistakes. So the ABA, the last time it dealt with it was decades ago, said you didn't have to tell your client. You did have to tell the other side. There's some cases where the courts have made mistakes. There was a Maryland ethics opinion where the court made a mistake, and they say, well, you've done your duty by telling the clerk that there's a mistake there. But the scrivener's error one is really interesting to me because it seems the ABA's approach anyway is inconsistent with the ABA's handling of other kinds of mistakes, not scrivener's mistakes. Substantive mistakes, I think we agree on, you don't tell the other side unless you want to avoid litigation or something. Scrivener's error, apparently you do have to tell the other side, which seems, again, kind of counterintuitive. But I think I would be very wary of taking advantage of the scrivener's error.
Okay. We're running down about 8 minutes left on the discussion time. The last question that was on our assigned list here was talk about ethics. Let's talk about ethics and negotiating process. And we've touched on that throughout here, Tom. But what's the dividing line between zealous representation versus outright deception? And again, it may be the question of what is fact versus negotiating position. What's your take on that?
Well, you're exactly right. Yeah, the statement of a statement of material fact. I mean, the example everybody uses is if you're in some kind of a labor negotiation and you can't lie about what the employee health care plan costs. You clearly can't do that. You can puff, as we talked about. You can puff about your intent for sure. That's, you can clearly do that. And I'm always reminded, I think the word puff is just a hoot because it's not even a neutral word. It's such a soft sounding, pleasant word. I'm always reminded of George Carlin where he says that in football, there's the blitz and the red dog and the bomb. In baseball, you're safe and you get to go home. it's a very different, the wording is everything there. But so we're going to call it puffery, even though it's deceptive, it seems to me. So And as I say, I've seen that one of the keys is that you can't favor your own reputation, which is awkward. I mean, all of us, we don't want to get a reputation of being jerks, especially in, I practiced in Richmond, Virginia for 24 years, where it's a very small bar and everybody would sort of get mad at you and shun you if you were a real jerk. But you have to remember what we do. We serve our clients. And so the zealous representation is what we owe our clients. Not to be jerky about it, but you take positions because that's our job. And a lot of times when I talk in the litigation world and people will say, well, you know, I want to try to be a nice guy. The example I give is in the litigation world here, and I'll ramble for a minute, I guess, is what would you do if the door opens and you and your client are going up to the seventh floor of the courthouse, it opens on the fifth floor and you see the other side's exhibits, they've been delivered to the wrong floor. Would you tell the other side, or would you just stay silent and let them kind of panic and maybe start the trial in sort of a panic mode and maybe just set them off course? Most people would say, well, I'd be professional. I'd tell the other side that their exhibits are on the wrong floor just to be nice about it. But I could or let's say an inadvertent transmission. But then what I'll sometimes do is say, okay, well, let's say it's a criminal trial and your wife was murdered by these people. Would you tell, would you tell a bad guy that their client they're on the wrong floor? And generally they would say, oh no, you know, it depends on sort of the setting for it. And that's human nature, it seems to me. But if you're going to be serving yourself, you've got to serve our client is the main thing that we do. So the line is tough. The client's clearly, as you said, Tony, between the puffing and the statements of fact. That's for sure. I can't do that. But 4.1 is in the representational capacity. 8.4 is our whole life, and they prevent deception. But we know that you can kind of nibble around the edges in the original negotiation. I think we agree. You don't have a duty to tell the other side about bad law. You don't have a duty to tell the other side about bad facts. You don't have a duty to tell the other side that it made a mistake. I think the ethics rules would require you to tell the other side they made a scrivener's error if there's been a meeting of the minds, and because that's, as the ABA said, that's what's material. I wouldn't do that. But I think that if people confuse zealous representation, sort of positional work that we do for our lawyers, with being jerks. It's one thing to scream at somebody and, you know, pound on the table. That's professionalism. That's civility. You can be a very zealous advocate for your client and still be polite. And that's, to me, that's the difference between professionalism and ethics. But I'd love to get your take, because you've been doing this for a long time.
I tell the younger lawyers all the time that we must strive to be able to disagree without being disagreeable. And, you know, you can be very zealous, you can be very aggressive, you can certainly represent your client aggressively and present their case passionately and aggressively, but you can't step over the line and do things that are, you know, improper or just wanting to win at all costs. So sometimes people get caught doing that misbehavior, sometimes they don't. And even if you don't get caught, you still have to live with yourself every day and wonder about, at the end of the day, what kind of person are you going to be? And what kind of practice are you going to have? And how are you going to conduct yourself and carry out your career? And unfortunately, I've had, I guess I probably had pretty good luck overall most of the time whenever we had a ethical dilemma such as we've talked about today, I've been able to prevail on the clients usually the trick to getting them to agree to that, Tom, is to appeal to their sense of what I call, I said this earlier, enlightened self-interest.
Right.
They may get a short-term situational advantage by not telling the other side something, but sooner or later in these things, typically people figure it out, and once they figure it out, then you got yourself in a bigger mess. So what's the net end game associated with all of that? I don't quite get that. So,
well, that's a tribute to you that you can talk your clients into that. You're right. What worries me, I guess, is that a lot of young lawyers think they don't have to bring their clients into the conversation. Like these law students said, I think it's up to the client to make that decision, and it's up to you to try to talk the client into doing what's the best thing.
Right. Well, I believe that it's just about time now for us to open the program to questions from our listeners. Operator, would you please provide our listeners with instructions on how they can ask their questions?
If you wish to ask a question, please press the star key on your touch-tone phone, followed by the 1 key. That's star 1. When you do, you will be told your place in line. To get out of the queue, just press the pound key. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
Tom, while we're waiting for listener questions, I'd like to ask you, nobody more expert in America on these great questions of and I love all the hypothetical treatments of these situations. I'd say I probably got about a 50% today on answering them. But my answers have been seasoned, I think, with a lot of career experience. Where do you see it heading? What's the future hold for us?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because I just read an article a while ago about, and I'd love to get your take on this, whether you're seeing this in your practice, but the AI creating documents, that is, people using AI to create contracts instead of paying lawyers to create contracts, and apparently it's leading to more typos, just understandable, but not everyone is as careful as you are reading it from scratch over the weekend. And so, ironically, I think there's going to be more of the Scrivener error typo kind of situation, and that's one where I think there's a mismatch between what you'd expect the ethics rules to say, which is, oh, it's another mistake, take advantage of it, where the ABA's decades of silence saying the last time it spoke on it, I think deliberately not speaking on it since then, would be to say, no, you got to tell the other side about those AI-generated typos. So I think that's a trend that I see. But are you seeing more of your clients hoping they don't have to pay you and instead to use it paying AI?
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting. I've just spent, you know, over the last month, two separate meetings with vendors who were actively developing AI-related products. I told them a story. They didn't like what I had to tell them. I told them a story that I was associated with another law firm in the past, very big, prominent now international law firm, which had spent a period of time, some years back, trying to do exactly what you're talking about. They want to try to write algorithms that would say, let's take a will. You're going to write a will for somebody. So question number one is, are you married? Yes or no? If it's yes, then you ask the next question. If the answer to that is yes or no, then you ask, well, it doesn't take very long, as we all know, before that algorithm gets into multiple layers of variables. Do you have children? Yes. Well, is the children by the married person that you're married to or somebody else? You know, the questions that can come up are pretty far-reaching, and it's very difficult then to write the program to say, okay, well, if you're now in permutation number 47, but you're also in permutation number 256, how do you write a clause that jives with those two without being able to think about it? Because that's what the AI is going to do. It's going to mathematically crunch through all of these permutations and pair up the package that it puts out as output. And, of course, the great advantage of the computer is it can crunch all those permutations at the speed of light, but right, it still has to make sense at the end of the day. And whether or not the machines are able to do that, Tom, I don't know. If they can drive a car, they maybe will be able to do it with writing a will, but I'm pretty confident that they won't be able to do it before I retire. So with that,
I'm 67, so I got a couple of years left. I'm hoping out before then, but it's coming. I mean, I think the next generation is going to have to deal with it, but it's leading to these ethics issues coming up more and more on the typo side. But I'm with you, but I don't want to be an old curmudgeon-y kind of guy and say, oh, it'll never work, because if the people make it work, probably it's kind of scary for me.
They probably will. So then the question will become, Tom, if they get the AI and the document cranking out and it still makes mistakes, who's going to have the malpractice liability for that?
Oh, Great question. Yeah, you're right. It may be is it the AI guy or is it the maker of it? Yeah, it's like the car thing, like you said. I didn't even think of this, but somebody said the AI in the car will have you, the driver, drive off the edge of a cliff rather than running over 30 school children. But who's gonna buy a car like that?
Let me just ask the operator. Operator, do we have any questions that have come in while we've been sitting here convincing?
There are no questions from the phone lines at this time.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. I think that's all the time that we have today. If you were not able to ask your question, or if one occurs to you later, our contact information has been provided on the written material. And you're absolutely welcome to contact Tom or myself. We'd be happy to respond to your questions if you do that. So this is Tony Licata, and on behalf of Tom Spahn and myself, I'm thanking you for joining us today. Operator?
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's broadcast.